From Sounds True, Dr. Quantum presents A User's Guide to Your Universe, Session 3, What Consciousness Does, with Fred Allen Wolf.
Hi. We're now in the third session. This one deals with this whole question of the mind in the body. Actually, we're going to start off by looking at where we ended up last time. We ended up last time really looking at this whole business about, does mind create reality? Is there an out there? Well, what I didn't tell you, I need to tell you now, because it really applies to how the mind acts in the body by looking at how the mind seems to be acting in the physical world that we see out there. Because what it really is telling us is the distinction which separates that stuff which is out there from what we think is in here ain't so firm and fixed as we would like it to be. And that maybe what we call the body may not be just what's confined to our visual sensorial experience of our body. Namely, I got my hands, I got my toes, I got my head. Maybe there's something more than just I got my body. Maybe there's something else going on. And maybe what this is telling us has something to do with not only is our body just what is seen by our eyes, but maybe our body really extends far beyond what we normally conceive of as even our body. And what this is getting to is something which really is the relationship between mind and body, or, if you will, what consciousness does, what it actually does. Now, let's try to paint the story by giving you some of the various colors we're going to use to paint the story. The first thing we have to understand, the first very basic thing, is that things are complementary. That just because you see things one way, that doesn't mean that's the way they really are. And that you can see them another way, and it would be very different from the way you first saw them. And it doesn't mean that the second way is the way they really are. But in a way, they can be even contradictory. It was Walt Whitman who said, "Do I contradict myself? Well, very well then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes." And each of you out there is large, containing multitudes. You're not just confined to your body. And in order to get that clear, let's tell you a little more about this story. It really began with Niels Bohr again, you know, the guy who discovered that electrons were making quantum jumps inside of atoms. He realized when he had heard Heisenberg come up with his idea of the indeterminism principle, the uncertainty principle, and when he recognized what Max Born was saying about probability theory, that the waves are really not physical waves, but waves of possibility, he began to realize that there was some kind of principle in operation here, which he called the principle of complementarity, which said that when you look at things a certain way, that's what you see. Look at them another way, you see something different. And the thing he was most concerned about in his day was something called the wave and the particle, meaning when you look at things in a wavy way, it looks wavy. When you look at things in a particle way, it looks particulate. In other words, he was trying to answer the whole question that Einstein was worried about when that electron wave came to that dish and left itself, whether it would look wavy or become a particle. And he says the experiment was designed to bring out the particleness of it, and you could do it another way, and you might see the waviness of it. Well, it turned out that it wasn't quite that way, but it nevertheless gave people an inkling into the fact that you couldn't know everything at once. You couldn't grab onto the whole secret of what's going on at once. You had to allow for this principle, which was called the principle of complementarity. It's a difficult principle to really understand because it's very, very paradoxical. But there is something that we all understand in our own human nature, which illustrates it probably better than I can try to explain to you in simple terms, in terms of particle experiments. But I will try. But first, let's start off with something you do understand. You know that you feel, and you also know that you think. And you probably have relationships with other people in your life. And you know that you can think about the situation that you're in with your relationship with that other person, say a girlfriend or a boyfriend or whatever, and the other person may feel about the situation that you're in. And because feelings and thoughts really don't always correspond, we say they are complementary to each other. One complements the other. One feels a certain way about something, and then one can think about it, and the act of thinking about it can actually change the feeling so that the feeling changes sometimes in a way that you can't always predict. Let's say you're in a relationship and your partner says, I feel that this is a good situation. I feel that this color of this dress on my body, it really makes me feel like a whole new person. And you, by the way, are looking at the dress on her, and you realize it makes her butt end look fatter. And what are you going to do? Are you going to tell her this? Or what are you going to do? So you say, well, you know, you decide to finally bite the bullet. You say, you know, it makes your butt look fatter. And she goes, what? What? And she gets all excited and she starts yelling and her feelings completely change and now she's angry at you and da-da-da-da-da-da. One thought and the feelings completely change. That's a complementarity. In this case, it was kind of dramatic. They don't always have to be very dramatic, but they tend to be that way when you're talking about feelings and thoughts. Another thing has to do with maybe how we sense the world. We all have sensations of the world, and we also have intuitions of the world. We intuit that if we do things a certain way, then that's likely to occur. We have the intuition that it's likely to occur. Very often we're so busy intuiting that we don't notice that we've cut ourselves or we're tripped and fell, or we're not always in touch with our bodily sensations when we're intuiting, and vice versa. When we're really in touch with our bodily sensations, we don't notice the things that are coming around the corner, so to speak. So intuiting and sensation are complementary to each other. This is what Jung talked about when he talked about the functions of personality, that we all have complementarity between thinking and feeling and between sensing and intuiting. So now let's look at how we apply this principle to a physics experiment. This is a classic kind of experiment in which this wave-particle duality or principle of complementarity between wave and particle really first began to show up. Here's how it goes. You got to imagine this, so put on your imagination hats for a little while here. I want you to picture that you have in front of you a screen, like a movie screen, okay? And I want you to picture that you're going to be looking at that screen. Now, just off to the side of the screen and in front of the screen, there is another screen that's completely black, except for two very narrow slits in the screen. Very narrow slits, like Venetian blinds. But let's pretend they're running vertically down the wall rather than horizontally across. It doesn't matter. They could be horizontal too, but let's make them go vertical, okay? And behind that screen, which has the two slits in it, there is a source of light, electrons, particles, whatever you want. Okay. Now we turn on the source, and here's what happens. We want to know where the particles go as they go from the source through the two slits onto the screen. Now, here's what we observe, okay? We observe that every time we turn a particle on, turn a source on, a particle flies through, goes through one of the slits, we think, and then lands on the screen. And we do another one. And then we get another dot on the screen. And then another dot on the screen. Can we imagine that little dots are flying up and appearing on the screen? Dot, 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 dot. Every time we're seeing where the particle lands. And we're seeing something rather interesting appear on the screen. Now, what is it that we're observing appearing on the screen is something called a wave pattern. What we're seeing is a bunch of slits on that screen, like the spaces between the teeth of a comb appearing on that screen. And that pattern tells us that what we must have been looking at wasn't particles at all, but waves, because that's a wave interference pattern. But hold on. We did the experiment. We know there were particles going through. There were particle, one particle after one particle after one particle, and they were landing on a screen, one particle, one particle, one particle, dot, 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 dot. But when we looked at all the dots together, we saw this wave interference pattern. Huh. What's going on? Was it a wave going through and landing? How did it do that? So now we decide we want to find out. We want to make sure that it wasn't just it started as a particle because we thought it did, and it ended as a particle because that's how it looked. Maybe it was a wave all along. So in order to find that out, we're going to make a little test. We're going to take those two slits, and we're going to watch which slit the particle goes through as it's traveling. And we do that. We have some way of looking, and we can see, it went on the right. No. This time on the left, on the right, on the left, on the right. And we watch it, and we see the same pattern of dots appearing on the screen, except something's changing. Now that we can see which slit they go through, the pattern that emerges is no longer that Venetian blind spaces between teeth on the comb pattern that emerged before. Now what emerges is a mishmash in which we can actually distinguish which dots came from the right slit and which dots came from the left slit. Wait a minute. You mean if we look to see which way the particles go through the slits, we can tell that they were particles traveling through, but if we don't look to see which slit the particles go through, they go through as waves? Yes, that's the idea behind the wave particle duality, or the idea behind what is called complementarity. In other words, we decide whether something behaves like a wave or like a particle. That's called complementarity. We have the choice there. In other words, we're shaping the reality. We're not only shaping the reality, we're shaping the history. We're shaping the whole course upon which those things actually move. This is the kind of thing that we bring to bear in the physical universe when we observe anything in the physical universe. And this is the way we believe consciousness influences the material world and influences the material that's contained in your human body as well. In other words, consciousness, by the acts of these complementary acts, the choices that you make, can alter and change the behavior not only of this thing we call the out there reality, but also the in here reality of what we call our bodies. Now, there's more to the story. You see, the separation between the out there world and the in here world, as far as we can tell, what governs what's out there and what's in here, is really the behavior of these quantum waves of possibility that I first began talking about in the first two sessions. So here we're looking at whether or not we can control or we have some influence on these waves. Now, here's the story. Here's what happens. You see, those waves describe possibilities spreading out over all of space until you decide to perform an experiment in which you focus it down, like, say, looking at one slit or another. And when you do that, you suddenly change the possibilities that are present in the whole out there world. So since you're changing the possibilities by your act of looking, notice that these changes are taking place through your active looking, but the question arises, how can that be? Because after all I'm doing is looking. I'm not really grabbing, I'm looking. I mean, it's happening out there, but I'm changing the way I'm thinking in here. I'm changing something I'm doing in here, and yet it's affecting out there. The problem arises as to where and how does such an effect take place. And the answer, as far as we can tell, is it doesn't take place out there, even though it looks like it takes place out there, and it doesn't even take place in here, even though we would like to think it's our minds taking place in here. But it seems to be something we call non-locality. It seems to be something which says it doesn't happen locally. It's something which happens everywhere at the same time. And we see the effect wherever we tend to look for it. This is called non-locality. It's a very important part of quantum physics, and it's a very important part of the way we understand the nature of the physical world. Now, because the physical world seems to depend on us in a very strange way, this can introduce some interesting paradoxes. Let me tell you about one. Back in the early 60s, I was a graduate student at UCLA, and I happened to have to leave the campuses in Los Angeles in order to travel up to the Bay Area of California and spend some time doing the rest of my research on my PhD thesis at the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory in Livermore. And while I was there, I had a chance to meet a rather remarkable young physicist whose name was William Newcomb. And Newcomb was always interested in the paradoxes which arise from quantum physics. And he once told me this paradox, which got my mind thinking, how would you resolve this? What he told me was the following. He said, suppose we have a magician, and the magician enters a room and seats himself before you, and he says to you, I am an enlightened being, able to witness the future now. I have a gift for you. I shall make you very rich if you believe in my powers. He then places before you two small safe deposit boxes. The box on the left is labeled L for left, and the box on the right is labeled R for right. And he speaks, in box L I have placed $1,000. It is yours. In box R, I have placed either $1,000,000 in large denominational bills, so it would fit in the box, of course, or I have placed nothing at all. You have two choices. Either you choose box R, or you choose both boxes. And you think, my God, what kind of, well, this is really stupid. I mean, well, huh? Either you choose box R or you choose both boxes. At first, you're kind of, you know, you're surprised. I mean, this seems kind of dumb. Well, I would think I would have to choose between the boxes. Why am I being asked to either choose box R or both? Now, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. And you're wondering, what the heck is going on? And then you realize that this is making some kind of sense. The magician says, you must have faith in me, and you must have that faith in order to get the $1,000,000. I can see into the future. I already know what you're going to choose. If you choose box R, I will reward your choice, and you will find $1,000,000 in the box. However, if you are greedy and you choose both box L and R, your reward will only be the context of box L by itself. You will only get $1,000 and that's it. He's confident. He's pretty sure of himself. But you think, come on, this is so hokey. Either he's put the $1 million in box R or he hasn't. And, you know, I'd rather get 1,000 plus 1 million rather than just a million alone, because I could use the $1,000 to take a vacation with and put the million in a bank. So I'm going to be greedy and choose both boxes. But then you go, oh, wait a minute. But he knows I'm greedy. He knows I'm a greedy SOB. He knows that I'm going to do that. So he's not put the $1 million in box R. There's nothing in that box R. He knows I'm going to choose both, and I'm only going to get the 1,000. So what can I do? What should I do? What should I do? Is there $1 million in the box R? Or maybe, can this guy really read my mind? If he can't read my mind, then what the heck is going on? If this being is just an ordinary being and not really who he says he is, then if he's just folks, he's just playing tricks on me. He, you know, it doesn't make any difference. There's nothing more he can do. He's already put the money in the box. He's not going to change anything. He told me it's up to me. I make the choice, and I can choose both or one. They're complementary. I can't choose both and choose one. I can either choose R or I choose both, L and R, or R alone. That's all. I can either choose R alone, which I get the million, or I choose them both and I get the million and 1,000. But that's what I think. He says I won't. He says I will get only the 1,000, because when I open up box R, it'll be empty. So I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know what should I do. And you're faced with the same paradox. What would you do in this case? If I choose both and I find that box R is really full, so I get a million and 1,000, I'm rich. But if box R is empty, wouldn't it have been so anyway? What difference does it make whether I choose both or not? I've lost nothing, so, you know, if the being is just an ordinary guy like me, I might as well choose both and get both. Okay? What would you do? Well, the surprising thing is these are quantum boxes, and they are illustrating the principle of complementarity. And if you're a smart quantum box chooser, you're not going to choose both boxes and only get $1,000, because indeed, if you choose both, you're going to find there's only $1,000 in box L and nothing in box R. But if you choose box R, $1 million will be in that box. In other words, what you get depends on what you choose. And you have the choice as to whether to choose both or choose one. And these are quantum things. These are paradoxical to your mind only because you believe that the reality is already out there, independent of you. But what quantum physics says, it ain't out there, independent of you. It depends on your choices. And choosing both boxes is complementary to choosing only box R. It's sort of like the wave or particle. Choosing both boxes is kind of like trying to figure out which slit the particle went through, in which case you don't see the wave pattern anymore. But if you don't look in both slits, if you don't look which way it went, then you're getting the wave pattern, and that's like choosing box R alone. So this is a little story to illustrate what is called the principle of complementarity. So now, here's where we are. We are at the point of recognizing that this quantum wave of possibility, whatever it is, really not only affects everything, but it really can affect us, and it can affect our bodies. And let me tell you a little bit about what's going on there. This is called the theory of quantum consciousness. Now, a lot of this is very speculative. I admit to you that these things are not absolutely proven. I'm just suggesting that this is what seems to be going on. Suppose that you had to be aware of every breath you took, every heartbeat, every peristaltic action, which you may be aware of if you're getting hungry right now. Clearly, if you had to watch all that stuff going on all the time, your mind wouldn't have much left over to regard anything new in life. I mean, you have to watch all the stuff that's going on all the time. Your attention would be so taken up with watching over all these what are called autonomic functions that you would not be able to take much note of the fact that the light just changed red, or to avoid even the simplest accident, like tripping over your own feet. To enable your mind to be free from these basic functions and yet still able to take over when necessary, because sometimes you have to watch where you put your feet, and sometimes you have to pay attention to your peristaltic action and your tummy, and sometimes you have to watch, you know, whether the light is too bright or too dull. Sometimes you got to do that kind of stuff. In order to be able to do that or not do it as necessary, requires a very subtle interaction between your mind and your body, certainly your mind and your brain. Now, we know from a study of the brain that the controlling structure for all this, for these autonomic functions, is located in the brain stem. It's called the reticular activating system, or the RAS. And the brain stem refers to a collection of these nervous structures found at the base of the brain, and the RAS is a diffuse collection of neurons found within the core of that stem. Now, in the interaction between the ordinary nervous system and the autonomic nervous system, there is a kind of an interaction there. That's where quantum physics seems to have an effect. It seems to suggest how consciousness can become autonomic when it needs to be, and not be so when it doesn't need to be. So we have to kind of imagine that there's a nerve signal from an organ, say from your heart, that passes along a nerve to the brainstem, and then there's a return signal which beams from the brainstem back to the heart. This return signal acts as a kind of a regulator. It's like a little traffic cop, and it causes the heart to beat faster or slow down, for example. Normally, we're not aware, conscious of this exchange of signals. They are what are called autonomic. But, you know, there are people who practice getting conscious of those signals. They're called yogis. And yoga is a way of actually learning to gain control of that. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later on. But right now, let's just look at this very simple thing, because it tells us something about how consciousness actually works. First, we have to think of the action of being consciousness itself is at a very primitive level, say at the level of a single neuron. And here a neuron in the RAS, in the RAS, knows of the signal from the heart, and it sends a signal back to the heart muscle. By know, I mean that an act of consciousness has occurred in which some complementary choice was made, and the quantum wave of possibility associated with it has been altered suddenly by the act of observation. This we might call popping the quantum wave. I often use the word quiff to stand for the quantum wave of the possibility, so I call it popping the quiff. So you can imagine that we're popping the quiff all the time in order to gain control over our hearts, for example. Okay, so each possibility in the quantum wave of possibility or in the quiff represents a possible observation of something that could take place. We already talked about that before. So if the quiff is not popped, then no return signal is generated from the brain and the heart receives no message to slow down or speed up. So the problem is that the neuron simply notes or fails to note the incoming signal. By the act of noting, the neuron alters the quiff suddenly and irreversibly, and this change introduces an interaction of enzymes within a neuron, as well as the protein gate structures that are embedded with the neuron's membrane, associated with the neuron firing, and all that blah, blah, blah goes on. A yogi in yoga has probably developed a very unusual RAS system of neurons. It can actually refuse to take notice of messages coming from the heart. This altered consciousness may be the key to this remarkable talent. The yogi actually puts his mind into an altered state of awareness, which probably is quite difficult to achieve. But under its sway, the RAS neuron remains in a state of consciousness in which it both, hear this, both has and has not fired at the same time. A kind of quantum paradox. Woo, 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 woo. It's Twilight Zone. Yeah, it's just like the old Newcomb paradox. It's this principle of complementarity again. He's just decided not to note. Okay? That's a very strange thing, but just imagine that now, okay? So the yogi has learned to not take note of the situation in which both possibilities occur simultaneously. This produces a different physical state that may even resemble a kind of sleep or meditation, a hibernation, maybe even death. This new state of awareness cannot be achieved without focusing awareness on something else, usually an image, a distant shore, perhaps, or some other peaceful scene. Although it's possible, I think, for these yogis, because they've learned to do this so well, to just simply let go. Simply let go. Let go. And that letting go, maybe the action of letting go, allows both the neuron to fire and not fire simultaneously to be present. So after much practice, this non-noting of what's going on seems to occur, and they're able to achieve it. Now, inside the yogi's brain probably lies some kind of secret observer, although we've looked inside, we never found one. But let's just imagine that there's a field of consciousness in there that chooses. I don't know what it looks like, but suppose that's there. This same observer lies inside of each of our brains, and in fact, he must be in every neuron of every cell of the body. This observer chooses to take note or not to take note of the possible events bombarding our nervous system every billionth of a second. So uncertainty is always associated with the actions of this little tiny quantum physical observer, and the result of observing action is to produce a change in the state of the neuron. It either fires or it doesn't fire. That reflects this. This may be happening at the level of a little tiny enzyme in a long complex protein molecule, for example, or it could be happening somewhere else. And there might be two possible configurations of that little enzyme, A or B. Remember our right and left in the quantum box experiment that I talked about before in Newcomb's paradox? If noted, then it will be found to either be A or B. But if it is not noted, then it will be neither A nor B, but it'll be A and B at the same time. So the two possibilities are A and B at the same time, or A or B, one or the other. So this is a way I think the RAS and heart are in relationship to each other at the neuronal level. Once trained, the neuron continues to notice itself in the mixed A or B state, with the result that after several such occurrences, the neuron is either one way or the other. And quantum physics tells us that this would hold if some outside observer were to even look and see the neurons firing and make a choice of observing, he would see it to be A or B. When the yoga alternates between normal observation of what we might call the supermind, which overlooks the A or B contents of these little mini-minds, and the supermind enters the relaxed state of A and B, then he creates in his supermind control of the heartbeat. And when this is taking place, it's very remarkable, it's nevertheless difficult to observe, when this is taking place, the yoga is gaining control. And this is how the yogis can learn to stop or stop their hearts by going into these paradoxical states. Aside from the yogic ability to control the heart, we all have our hearts beating autonomically most of the time, the whole development of an autonomic functioning has really taken advantage of this whole business of noting A or B, one or the other, and this is what consciousness is doing in the body. It's taking note. But you can also train yourself to not take note, to go into the A and B state. And when you do that, you begin to enter at what are called extraordinary states of consciousness. And these extraordinary states can lead into some really interesting new possibilities, even the possibility of time travel. And we're going to get into that in a section coming up. Meanwhile, there's something else going on here. How is it possible that I can take note of A and B, that is, the neuron firing and not firing at the same time? I mean, your mind automatically says, it's got to be one or the other, got to be one or the other, got to be one or the other. And here I'm saying, telling you, that it's possible for your body to be in a state in which it's both one and the other at the same time. Well, what's going on? Are you having two bodies? Well, not only are you having two, but if you let all that A and B stuff happen everywhere in all the neurons of your body and all the cells of your body at the same time. 2 times 2 is 4 times 2 is 8 times 2 is 16. Keep multiplying. You're going to get an infinity, practically, or a large number anyway, of parallel or alternate realities popping into existence as a result of you using the principle of complementarity to pay attention or not pay attention. And if you can do that, you're beginning to see how you can enter into alternative realities at the same time. And in physics, we call those parallel universes. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about those in the next session, session 4. So stay tuned.
This concludes session 4 of Dr. Quantum Presents, The User's Guide to Your Universe with Fred Allen Wolf. Our program continues with session 5.
Okay, we've just completed learning about how the mind enters into your body or is in your body or wherever it happens to be and what consciousness does. And I even gave you some ideas about what yogas can do, whether they can stop their hearts or get them going, and all this stuff about choice and complementarity, and you know how that all works now. So now we're going to be looking at something that's kind of implied by all that complementarity that I didn't quite really state very fully, but now we're going to state it head on. And that is, when you complementarily choose A and B, in the neuron case, remember, how can you be choosing to note your neuron is firing and note your neuron is not firing at the same time? Are A and B both choices available to you as if in parallel worlds? We're back in Twilight Zone time again. And remember the little paradoxical story about the magician who says you can choose R or you can choose R and L, but you know, if you choose R and L, I won't give you the $4 million, but if you choose R alone, all that kind of stuff. All that makes sense when we look into this other phase of all of this, which is called parallel realities, parallel universes. And we begin to inquire into the question, do you live in parallel universes or in one of them, all of them, none of the above? Okay, so what are parallel universes? Well, let me start off with a little quote. There's a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There's another theory which states this has already happened. That's Douglas Adams, the restaurant at the end of the universe. He's one of my favorite to quote. Let me give you another one, as long as I'm into quotes right now. No experience, ordinary, everyday, usual or unusual, whether impressions, ideas, dreams, visions, or memories, strange, bizarre, familiar, weird, psychotic, or sane, are objective facts. None of the above. Anyway, parallel worlds takes us into this never-never world, the world of the imaginal, but yet is a world so compelling that it is now led into a whole new way of doing and thinking and working with this thing we call quantum physics. It's led into new ways about thinking about, for example, time travel. It's led into new ways of thinking about even computers and how they operate. But what are these parallel universes? Why do we think they're important? Are they real? And even more important, what is it going to do with me? How is it going to change my life? What is it going to do to make my life any different? Do they affect me, my mind, the way I behave in some way? Well, first, let's talk a little bit about what they are. What exactly are parallel universes? Well, you know something? They've been in our consciousness for quite some time. Maybe some of you out there are Trekkies, you know, fans of the Star Trek series when it first came out, and where Captain Kirk, in beaming up, finds himself on a parallel universe spaceship in which the other characters are all evil renditions of their goodly renditions in the real, so-called real universe. In this parallel dark black universe, they're all evil. And Kirk is crossed over from one universe into the other. Meanwhile, his evil Kirk, just as he's gone into the evil universe, the evil Kirk has gone into the good universe. And in the good universe, because he's so evil and weird, all the good people lock him up in the brig on the spaceship Enterprise. But in the evil universe, Kirk, being a smarty pants, knows that he should behave in a certain way in order to not attract the attention of these evil, weird characters that are his same shipmates that he had before, but now they're all behaving this weird way. Nevertheless, he decides that he's going to change things and do the right thing or whatever. Anyway, it's a good story, but it's only a story. There are other stories in which there are doppelgangers, doubles that come in. Another person appears in place of you and does things that you wouldn't do. These are examples of how parallel realities can enter into what we call the so-called reality. There are many, many other stories about parallel realities, but actually, what exactly are they and where do they come from? What makes them appear? Well, now, remember when I told you about this double slit experiment? And I explained to you that the particle leaves can go through two slits and then it ends up on a screen, and how it, the pattern of the different hits that these particles make when they go through these double slits is different than if you start to look to see which slit they go through. Well, there's another way of looking at all of this. This is a way that actually a physicist, David Deutsch, points out in one of his books. It's called The Fabric of Reality. And at any rate, here's what he says. He says, there is a universe in which the particle goes through slit L and then hits the screen. There is a universe in which that same particle goes through slit R and hits the screen. In other words, both universes exist side by side, parallel, like pages in a book. And at the spine of the book, where the particle first gets emitted, it splits into these two versions of itself, which are still it. So it is an it in two. It's two its, if you will. It's it and it. And the it and it go through each slit separately and then arrive on the screen where they come back together again, I guess. Anyway, when you look at that, you wonder what the heck's going on. Well, what Deutsch says is that even though in each universe, the other universe is invisible to it, it nevertheless has an effect upon it. It sends a kind of a vibration, if you will, into it. And in fact, the one way that we quantum physicists have learned to deal with this kind of weird stuff is that we actually play with the idea that when these particles travel, even though they go through one slit or the other, that when they actually move, they're actually kind of like oozing a kind of vibration. They're actually kind of doing a dance. They're do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do as they're going. And when one is going do and the other is going do, then the low note can actually influence the high note and from one world to the next, and it causes a kind of an interference. So in other words, even though the universes are parallel, there is an influence of one upon the other. That's how Deutsch looks at this whole thing. In other words, even though these universes are parallel, they're not quite completely apart from each other, and one can influence the other. And that's what leads to all the weirdness of quantum physics, is this effect of one thing affecting the other. Well, if that's the case, fine. So parallel universes indeed have some effect one upon the other. Can there be more than just two? Well, there could be an infinite number. Do you remember I told you about the atom at the very beginning? And I explained to you about something we call the atom of hydrogen and how it looked. You can think of it in parallel universes in the following kind of way. In every universe, there is an electron having one particular point in space and time. In the next universe, it's in an entirely different place in space and time, in its universe. In another one, in a different place. In fact, when you add up all these infinite number of possibilities, what you get is a cloud of possibilities. A cloud of possibilities for all the electrons. And when you look at all of the universes like one on top of another, as if they were pages in a book that you can see through, like, you know, flimsy pieces of cellophane plastic and the little dot on each one, you see all the dots coming through them all that forms a cloud pattern. And that is another way that we can understand parallel universes, as the pattern of all of the universes coming through. So all of these are ways in which we use the notion of parallel universes. And you might ask, why do we do that, Dr. Wolf? I mean, what's the point of it all? I mean, why do you do that? Well, the answer is, surprisingly, that this is one way we can explain what we do, us, how we behave, what we do when we observe anything. Because we can say the following picture. If we try to find where the electron is, and we simply ask ourselves that question and then go about making the observation, our mind splits into all of the possible positions that the electron can find itself in, and we become split into an infinity of parallel universes. Talk about schizophrenia. This is mad schizophrenia with a vengeance. We're in all of those universes at once, and that is so bizarre that our minds simply say, oh, come on, have mercy. I can't take all of that. But you have to, if you take time and look at it, what it's really saying is that this thing you call your mind is itself an infinite number of parallel realities, and you are that which looks at all of them together or separately, depending on whether or not you focus in or don't focus in. It's like what the yogis do, as I told you in the previous session. Their minds can go into both realities at the same time, firing and not firing simultaneously, which means, in a sense, they are in parallel realities, and they are taking the effect of the not noticing as being their presence. So they're in both realities at the same time and having an experience of both realities at the same time without having the experience of either reality. And yet when they start taking note, which is the way we do when we want to pin things down, notice where something happens, find out something, then we enter into one of those possibilities or the other. But according to this picture, the parallel realities picture, you are actually entering into them all. And noticing which one you're in is different than entering into them all and not paying attention which one you're in. So the whole thing depends on a simple vote. Pay attention, don't pay attention. Take note, don't take note. And that seems to be the way choice, your actual choices, work. You just decide how to take note or how not to take note. So, this is how the idea of mind enters into all of this picture. In a story written by Ursula Le Guin called The Lathe of Heaven, a hero is faced with a very awful reality. His dreams come true. I'm going to talk a little bit about dreams in an upcoming session, but let me just go back to the story for a moment. His dreams come true. Whatever he dreams becomes real the instant he awakens from his dream. When he awakens, he sees a new universe. He realizes after a while that he is actually not just dreaming. He is traveling from one parallel universe to another. After each time he dreams, he wakes up in a parallel universe. And everything in that universe is totally consistent with itself, not with the other universes. No one else in that universe has any memory of any of the other universes. The only difference is that he, our hero, remembers the other universes he inhabited before he went to sleep. Can our minds actually do this? Can we awaken in other worlds when we sleep? It just might be that while dreaming, our minds not being fully occupied with the reality we're in, after all, we're dreaming. Maybe we're able to perceive these other universes. This is speculation. I'm speculating. But maybe the key to traveling to other universes is to simplify the mind. The world may just have too many distractions, such as the art of survival, or as it was written in the ancient Chinese, the art of war, the art of survival in the concrete jungles of modern life. Perhaps the whole idea is to make these journeys into other universes in our dreams. So, what would be going on there? Is it possible? Can the mind enter into these parallel universes? Well, the major problem that we physicists have come to in our discussion of the physical world is the fact that the mind does play a role in it. We can't seem to get out of it. And what physicists have been trying to do is find some way to explain the presence of mind in a way that they're accustomed to explaining anything, namely through the equations of quantum physics. And so when these parallel universes were first invented, people were looking for a mechanical kind of mechanism that would allow the mind to play the same kind of game as the electron does. If the electron can be in multiple realities at the same time, then the mind goes into multiple realities at the same time. And there were a number of physicists that thought this way in the middle 50s. Physicists Bryce DeWitt and Hugh Everett, John Wheeler, Neil Graham, they all were experimenting with this idea of parallel realities, that somehow the mind just enters into all of them and gets horribly entangled in all of them and continues to be entangled in all of them and overlaps of them all somehow produce some state of reality in which certain things aren't paid attention to anymore and that sort of thing. And it's a little bit difficult. I don't even know how to describe it to you because it's so confusing. You go kind of nuts if you're in all these universes at once. I mean, where am I after all? Well, another more conservative answer to how to deal with this came from another physicist whose name was Fred Hoyle, who is the Royal Astronomer and died in the middle 90s. He was a rather remarkable guy, and I've always admired his work. He believed that the many universes are an overlap of messages coming from the future, and that when we become aware of them, we're tuning to a possibility, to a possible universe. And the other messages, therefore, just get lost forever. They aren't listened to, so they go down the toilet. They're vanished. They're gone. They're goodbye. Goodbye. And in this case, the present universe is cut off from evolving to a future universe whose message was not received. So the direction we go in is a direction in which we have been paying attention. And if we're not paying attention, we don't go there. So in other words, there's a looping off of all the possible branches that are possible from the future, and only are we paying attention to that one branch that we're able to hear. So Hoyle believed that it's in that process of not choosing, but paying attention to only one of the possibilities, that that's really what consciousness does. That's the role of consciousness, tuning to a particular future rather than tuning to them all. Hoyle also pointed out that if all the other branches really existed, then it would be possible to have a record in the present that contains memories of these other universes. Not just the universe we happen to be in now, but even abnormal universes, ones that we may not at the particular moment remember right now. He once wrote a story that illustrated this. It was a kind of a science fiction story. He was, by the way, the Plumian Professor of Astronomy and founder of the Institute of Theoretical Astronomy at Cambridge University. He was knighted in 1972, and he was awarded the Royal Medal by the Queen of England. He's widely known for both his contributions to theoretical physics and the discovery of a very subtle energy relationship which takes place in the middle of the sun in stars, which allows helium atoms to fuse together to form carbon. And without this subtle discovery, we wouldn't have known how that actually occurred. He put it in an article that if these other universes were actually present all the time, it'd be possible to wake up every morning beside a different spouse, assuming you're married, although your memory each morning would always be consistent with the spouse of the day and will therefore be entirely aware that you ever had those other possibilities at all. So Hoyle was pointing out how very important it is that consciousness makes choices. It chooses what we see, and it chooses what we actually say is real. So parallel realities, then, to put it in a nutshell, is the choices that are possible. And in the Hoyle way of looking at it, only the one voice from the future that's paid attention to turns out to create the reality we're in. Whereas in the other ways of looking at it, all the voices are heard and all the parallel realities develop, and we are moving through them all in a very schizophrenic, madcap way. Which is real? Which is the actual solution? Well, it turns out that we don't know. And because we don't know, it's because we have no way of deciding for sure what actually is going on. That's why quantum mechanics is such a very strange business, as I said at the very beginning of this. It's stranger than we imagine. It may be stranger than we can imagine. To make this perhaps a little clearer, I'm going to tell you a story. It's actually about a knight. We might call this the story of the knight and his alter egos. Or once upon a time, 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 upon a time. Go on forever with that. Once upon a time, there was a knight in Shining Arbor who had to face a dragon. Being somewhat reluctant, he decided to flip a coin and see by the choice of the gods of chance whether or not he would fight the beast on that day. So, he carried out an experiment. And since this is a fairy tale, he flipped a coin. But before he observed the coin and the side of it landing face up, he decided, as most of us would upon anticipating an unsatisfactory turn of the coin, to go 2 out of 3 and flip the coin again. But this angered the gods of chance, and they sent one of their mist, the quantum god, to him. The god then told him, "Because of your fear, you must enter upon a journey to strange lands called parallel universes. At first, you must enter 2 of these parallel universes before you flip the coin a second time." Now, the knight is not necessarily the brightest guy. I mean, knights usually are pretty brave, but they're not always smart. Anyway, the knight doesn't really know what this all means and hasn't got the foggiest idea. So he agrees, for after all, you know, it should be better to enter upon the quantum gods, parallel world denizens, whatever they might be, than fight the fierce, fearful, foul, fiery dragon. So having said this, the god departed, and the knight, with some trepidation, observed the coin that had already fallen on the ground. But then, lo and behold, what he saw was not at all what he expected. For with the simple act of observation, he found himself in 2 parallel universes at the same time. The knight wondered, "Who is the real knight? Is it me or me?" Both of them were saying this, by the way. "For the knight was cursed. He can sense himself in both worlds at the same time. Oh, Lord, the knight was cursed with schizophrenia." So, as all stories go, the knight was not at all happy, for he could not make up his schizophrenic mind. In one world, he had seen heads, and in the other, at the same time, he had seen tails. Did he go out to fight the dragon? Or did he stay in the castle and contemplate the latest love of his life? Still being in a quandary, and without thinking about it any further, he decided to flip the coin a second time. And when it was flipped, the knight and his coin found that each of the previous worlds he had inhabited had once again split to accommodate 4 possibilities. In other words, there were now 4 parallel worlds caused by the 2 interactions of the knight and his coin. Now, each alter ego of the knight had seen one coin, and each saw one of the four possible sequences of heads and tails. One of them saw a head and then a head. The other one saw a head and then a tail. And the next one saw a tail and then a head. And the third, fourth one saw two tails. But this didn't help the knight one bit, because again he was split into all of the worlds. So the god of chance appeared and he said, "Hold on, old knight, what seems to be the problem?" "I can't make up my mind. Or is it my mind's?"
"Well, let me give you a hand. It's your memory that's going bad. Let me do a little rearranging of the sequences you remember. Maybe that will help."
So when the knight was not looking at the coins on the floor, the god of chance, the quantum god, changed the memory of the knight and the coin in one world from a head-head to a tail-head. And he changed the memory of the knight and the coin in world three from a tail-head to a head-head, and so forth. Now, when the god vanished, as gods are often inclined to do when the going gets tough, the knight looked around and wondered, did this help? Not at all. For after all, the rearranging of his memory and the coin didn't make any difference. He was right back to where he had started. He was still in four worlds, and all four possibilities of the two flips of the coin were still there. So again, the knight flipped the coin, making three flips altogether, and each of the previous four parallel worlds split again, making a total of how many? Eight. And the knight was even more confused, being now in eight bodies and eight minds. Again, the god appeared, and again he rearranged the knight's memory and the coin in each world. But at the end of it all, the knight was still in all eight worlds, and all eight sequences of the three coin flips were still there. So he flipped the coin a fourth time. This guy does not want to fight this dragon. So he flipped the coin a fourth time, and you know what happens. There were now 16, and 16 worlds. And each world, a knight saw a coin lying on the floor in the castle, and in each world, a light lead. He remembered how the coin had previously landed, but he was maybe flipped around by the quantum god. But his memory was playing tricks on him, because the god had once more rearranged the coins and his memory in each parallel universe, and the tricks didn't change anything. The knight, being even more confused, decided to flip a fifth time. And as all stories go, the gods of chance intervened once again and said to each alter ego, now there were 32 in all, each knight at the same time,
"We are bored with this display of cowardice. One of you must go and face the dragon."
But the knights quivered on the castle corner and started to flip the coin again. But before they did, a dragon entered the castle, actually 32 castles, and ate the knight, first roasting him with his breath. Of course, since knights are a bit stringy when eaten raw. And that's the end of our story. So what does the story teach us? What if we stopped at any point along the way, the third flip, the fourth flip, or whatever? Well, what this is telling us is that as far as we can tell, if the gods of chance or whatever gods come into our worlds and do this kind of flipping back and forth, changing head-head worlds to tail-head or whatever, and back and forth like that, we ourselves would not be able to tell the difference, because everything altogether is still the same. And that's the important thing. And that's what got Hoyle all upset, because he said that would mean that we could, every day we wake up in a different universe and we would never know it, because whatever was happening in that universe would seem consistent with where we are right now. And that was, we would wake up, look around, be in an entirely different world, not have any idea we're in a different world, and everything would seem perfectly logical. Have you ever had an opportunity to do that? I got to tell you something. It's happened to me, but it happens in what I call lucid dream states. I'll talk about dreams a little later on. But I just want to tell you that this bizarre story may have an element of reality when we take into consideration how it affects our dreams. So even though we can't experience the flippings and the changes and the transformations, they may actually be taking place. And even if they're not taking place, what this is telling us is if we can't tell a difference between whether the god of chance is doing this or not doing it, it's telling us that there's no difference either way. It means just what I said before. We can wake up in one universe or another universe and not know that we flipped from one to the other. remember I told you about waking up that Fred Hoyle talked about the smiles of the day? Let me add another little story to that. In a tiny village in New Hampshire, Mr. Jones goes to sleep next to Mrs. Jones one quiet Sunday evening. Nothing very strange about that. Mrs. Jones smiles at her husband sleepily and remembers the violets he brought home for her birthday, something he rarely manages to do because the poor dear works so hard at the office. She really thinks he spends so much time, too much time at the offices these days, and wonders if he really should do that. His late-night meetings are also a bit of a strain for her, but Friday, the last Friday he did, he remembered something. He remembered that he brought flowers and brought her flowers, and she was quite pleased, even though she has hay fever, something he never quite seems to remember, even after 14 years of marriage, or is it 13? She can't quite remember. She falls asleep and dreams of knights carrying her from one castle to the next. When she wakes up bright and early the next morning, there lies Mr. Jones. Alongside of the bed, she sees the familiar shine of his heraldry brimming with reflected light from his shield. The familiar sounds of the peasants working in the fields fill her ears, and the smell of the horses from the king's stable reaches her delicate and sensitive nose. She awakens with a start and immediately begins one of her sneezing attacks. Mr. Jones wakes up and, surprised to be arising so early on a Monday morning after chasing bandits out of the castle stronghold last night, his wife smiles at him. "Sorry, but you do know how flowers make me sneeze. They are such lovely violets. But, dear, pay a little more attention to me and try not to spend so much time at the round table drinking beer and listening to that old fuddy tell such stories." Mr. Jones, that is, Sir Lancelot Jones, Esquire, to be more exact, looks down at Lady Gwen Jones, wondering if this was the same woman he married 13 years ago, or was it 14? The above episode implies that there are really two Joneses. One couple lives in the present, and the other in the past. They are really split off from the same Joneses' egos. Now, I've carried the story a bit far by placing the alter egos in two different time periods, but that is not impossible at all. In fact, that may be what's going on here. I'm speculating. I'm sure that wasn't Hoyle's original concern. He, I'm sure, would have had both Joneses living at the same time period. However, time is a bit of an embarrassment in quantum physics, as we're going to discuss in an upcoming session, and we don't exactly know what to do with it. But I'm going to suggest some things a little later on. Perhaps the future Joneses are all in communication with the past Joneses, and maybe they're in communication with even further past Joneses, maybe all the way back to amoeba's name Jones. Who knows? In fact, this may be how the mind or memory works. All time exists now, and memories and anticipations are messages from parallel worlds that exist in the future and the past, but at the same time, all lying side by side in the present. It's a weird, strange, bizarre world we live in. And in the next section, we're going to look at how time and space really work in this strange, bizarre world we live in, and see what time bends and space warps are all about. So thanks, and tune in again.
This concludes Session 3. Our program continues with Session 4. Do you live in parallel universes?